about these different stages of sacrifice in chapter 3. Mental knowledge is that thing that raises one. That raises one, that does the elevating in the different stages of consciousness. And even he's spoken about in the last section. What was the last section of chapter 3? Right, controlling lust and anger. And what does lust and anger cover? The knowledge of the soul, and therefore it will degrade the soul, because according to what knowledge we have, we work and act on that level. So because so much stress was given in chapter 3 on transcendental knowledge, naturally, chapter 4 is entitled Transcendental Knowledge, and it is about transcendental knowledge. Now, I've listed on the board the five sections of chapter 4, all having to do with transcendental knowledge. The first section is, I've written down TK, of course. To understand this great code, you have to understand what TK stands for. Anyone can guess what it stands for?
Transcendental knowledge.
Very good. Now, the first section is transcendental knowledge about Krishna, and the section numbers are the same. And this section talks about how to receive transcendental knowledge, and what is transcendental knowledge about Krishna, his body, his pastimes, why he comes, etc. Then, in the next section, which is 11 to 15, how to applying transcendental knowledge, because knowledge, for it to be effective, must be applied. And what Krishna explains in that is that he himself, in one sense, is awarding the fruits or the results of everyone's work. So first, in section A, Krishna's position has been established as the Lord. And in the second section, that he is the one awarding the fruits of work. But he's doing it in a neutral way, just according to the karma of the living entities. And it's actually not Krishna who's doing it, but it's the modes of material nature who are doing it, actually, material nature. Then, and that's applying transcendental knowledge. Krishna is it's applying it to work. And the result of applying the transcendental knowledge about Krishna's position, supreme yet aloof, to work is what one becomes liberated. Then in the third section, understanding karma on the platform of transcendental knowledge. In this section, after understanding Krishna's position and then how it applies to work, transcendental knowledge applied to work, then there's another look at karma or work from the platform of jnana or from the platform of transcendental knowledge, because jnana and transcendental knowledge mean the same thing. And it's understanding how karma can be done or work can be done with jnana. And what do we call that? When karma is done with jnana? Yes, very good. You're catching on nicely. So this is going to explain in a philosophical way nishkam karma, understanding karma on the platform of transcendental knowledge. Then in section D, there's a long list of sacrifices of different activities showing that all the Vedic sacrifices and activities, from the austerities to the breath control, everything ultimately ends in transcendental knowledge. And there's some gradation of transcendental knowledge. Then finally, in section E, the conclusion is, it describes that because acting upon transcendental knowledge received in the disciplic succession is so powerful that it destroys all the reactions to one's deeds. And therefore, the conclusion is that Arjuna should fight and do his duty, but in transcendental knowledge. So those are the five sections, and we'll go over them, the verses in detail right now. Now, quite frankly, I find that right now, how many of you feel that you have a fairly good understanding of the third chapter? Okay, at least there's some of us. Now, I find that as we do chapters, even I get a really clear understanding of the third chapter, and then we do the fourth chapter, and I get a really clear understanding of the fourth chapter, and the third chapter starts fading a little bit, and by the time I'm up to the fifth chapter, I understand the fourth chapter pretty well, but what was that third chapter about again? But in this way, if we keep on going over it, we'll get a really clear idea of the Bhagavad Gita, especially if we understand the way the sections move together and how the chapters connect. And when we actually understand the Bhagavad Gita, it will give so much light. And of course, we all know how much we need light, because without light, it's impossible to see. And without seeing, how can there be proper activity? Okay. Now, after explaining, we'll go back from the beginning. I tried to give a summary over here. After explaining, and glorifying the importance of jnana through karma yoga, combining jnana and karma yoga in chapter 3, now Krishna is going to explain how Vivaswan, who was the root of the Kshatriya dynasty, attained the same knowledge. Krishna is using authority to describe transcendental knowledge. The personality of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna said, "I instructed this imperishable science of yoga to the sun god Vivaswan, and Vivaswan instructed it to Manu, the father of mankind, and Manu in turn instructed it to Ikshaku. This supreme science was thus received through the chain of disciplic succession, and the saintly kings understood it in that way. But in course of time, the succession was broken, and therefore the science as it is appears to be lost." Now, why is this science, which is so valuable, of transcendental knowledge, being now spoken to Arjuna? The next verse describes, Bhakto sime sakacheti rahasyam yetat uttamam. That because Arjuna is Krishna's devotee, Bhakto sime sakacheti. And also Krishna's sakka. What does sakka mean?
Friend,
because he's a devotee and he's a friend to Krishna. This rahasya, what does rahasya mean?
Mystery.
Mystery or secret. This secret is going to be revealed by Arjuna, to Arjuna by Krishna. That very ancient science of the relationship with the Supreme is today told by me to you, because you are my devotee as well as my friend, and therefore can understand the transcendental mystery of this science. So the hint is given, and it's also repeated in the 15th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, that actually only one who is a devotee can understand this science. Now, Arjuna calls Krishna in the next verse, he asks him a question. It's a doubt, and Krishna asks this because others may have it in their mind. He himself knows the answer. Arjuna said, "The sun god Vivaswan is senior by birth to you. How am I to understand that in the beginning you instructed this science to him?" So this doubt of something that seems impossible by material calculation, that Vivaswan is thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years old, and Krishna was born within the memory of Arjuna. So how could Krishna have instructed this to Vivaswan so long ago? So this achintya, or inconceivable fact that Arjuna asked Krishna about leads to Krishna deepening the transcendental knowledge that he's going to reveal to Arjuna. The first aspect of transcendental knowledge was that Krishna explained to Arjuna was how one receives it, and the answer is in the cyclic succession. Evam parampara praptam imam rajashio vidhu. Now, Arjuna asked, how is this possible that you explain this to Vivishwan? Because he's seen it to birth in you. And Krishna explains, many births both you and I have passed. I can remember all of them, but you cannot, O subduer of the enemy. So, here is the start in this section of intimate knowledge about Krishna. Krishna calls Arjuna, O subduer of the enemy, Parantapa. But another meaning of Parantapa is one who not subdues others, but one who gives to others. So Arjuna is giving the others the opportunity to hear this transcendental knowledge by asking that question. So Krishna has taken many, many births, but because his body is different from the living entity, although the living entity takes many births, Krishna can remember his, while the living entity cannot, because Krishna doesn't change his transcendental body. So here comes transcendental knowledge about Krishna and his body, which he is non-different from. Although I am unborn and my transcendental body never deteriorates, and although I am the Lord of all living entities, I still appear in every millennium in my original transcendental form. So Krishna, he explains why he appears, and the word is Atmamayaya. Atmamayaya. So Atmamayaya has many meanings, and one of them is by my internal energy, because Krishna's birth is not ordinary. He is not appearing by force. He is not under the modes of material nature, but he's appearing by his internal energy, Atmamayaya. And another meaning of Atmamayaya is that he's appearing by his mercy, because he desires it. Like the sun, the sun appears, it doesn't take birth, and it has an orbit. And similarly, Krishna, he comes and he goes according to his desire, and it is not according by his internal energy, by his mercy, and he is not taking birth like an ordinary living being. So Krishna is Ajopi, son of Vyayatma. So Krishna is Ajo, like the living entity is Ajo. Ajo means unborn. Ajo Api, although I'm unborn. So he is like the living entity, that he is unborn, but Krishna is Avyaya. His birth is different because his body is undeteriorating. It does not deteriorate. His body never ever deteriorates like that of the living entity. So here it begins to explain how Krishna is different from the living entity. Krishna is Aja, he is unborn, but he is Avyayam also. His birth isn't through karma like that of the living entity. The living entity, like, I don't say that I am born due to my Atmamayaya, by my mercy and according to my internal energy and according to my desire. And I might say it, but it would be a complete fabrication, a lie. But Krishna doesn't take his birth under karma, like we take our birth under karma, because he is Ishvara. Therefore, Bhutanam Ishvaro Pisan. That of all those are born, he is the Ishwar, or the Supreme Lord. Now, Prabhupada, in the teachings of Queen Kunti, very nicely explained something about his birth, about Krishna's birth. Now the Lord comes to deliver the devotees. Oops. I'm going to save this. Sorry. But don't worry. After two more verses, I'll read it. Now, so Krishna is explaining first transcendental knowledge about himself, that his body isn't ordinary, it's transcendental. He's not under the laws of material nature. He doesn't come by karma. He comes by his mercy. And he's never under karma. He's never under the laws of material nature. He is just working by his internal potency. Now, the next question is, when does Krishna come? And the answer is it according to Krishna's whim? Because we come according to karma. Whenever the modes of material nature decide that we come, we immediately take birth. But when does Krishna come? Whenever and wherever there is a decline in religious practice, O descendant of Bharata, and a predominant rise of irreligion, at that time I descend myself. And the word isn't born, but he appears. Bhavati, glaniya bhavati Bharata. He appears to take birth. Bhavati means appears to take birth. He becomes manifest. So Krishna's birth is not ordinary. And then in the next text, that was when Krishna is born. And here's why Krishna takes his birth and what he does. To deliver the pious and to annihilate the miscreants, as well as to reestablish the principles of religion, I myself appear millennium after millennium. And here's where we'll read what Prabhupada says from Kunti. This is an interesting point. Now the Lord comes to deliver the devotees. Puritranaya sadunam. That's that verse that we just read. Puritranaya sadunam. Vinishaya cha duskritam. Duskritam. But it clearly states in Bhagavad Gita 14:26 that a devotee transcends the material qualities. Sagunan samatityaitan. So, a devotee is in a transcendental position because he is no longer under the control of the three material modes of nature, goodness, passion, and ignorance. But if a devotee or a sadhu, paritranaya sadhunam, is already delivered because he's free from the modes of material nature, being on the transcendental platform, then where is the necessity of Krishna descending to deliver him? The question may arise, Prabhupada explains, that the Lord comes to deliver the devotee, but the Lord is already delivered. Therefore the word vidambanam means bewildering is used in this verse because this appears contradictory in the prayer of Queen Kunti. The answer to this contradiction is that a sadhu, a devotee, does not require deliverance. But because he is very much anxious to see the Supreme Lord face to face, Krishna comes not to deliver him from the clutches of matter from which he has already been delivered, but to satisfy his inner desire, deliver him from his anxiety to see Krishna. Just as a devotee wants to satisfy the Lord in all respects, the Lord even more wants to satisfy the devotee. Such are the exchanges of loving affairs. So Krishna comes to engage in pastimes with his devotees. And this is a very sweet way of understanding. And it's also explained that Krishna comes just because he feels like it. It is his independent desire, and this is his mercy on the living entity. Text 9. One who knows, now dhanma kama cha me divyam, one who knows the transcendental nature of my appearance and activities does not, upon leaving the body, take his birth again in the material world, but he attains my eternal abode, O Arjuna. So this is the result of knowing what was just said. So knowing means knowledge. So this is the result of transcendental knowledge, that one doesn't take birth in the material world, and another way of saying that is he's liberated. And so this verse in 9 it explains one result, and that's liberation. But text 10 explains another result. Being free from attachment, fear, and anger. Being fully absorbed in me and taking refuge in me. Many, many persons in the past became purified by knowledge of me. And thus they all attained transcendental love for me. So beyond liberation is this next stage of attaining transcendental love for Krishna. Puta manbhavam agata. That one attains transcendental love for Krishna. So this verse is very interesting.
without knowledge of Krishna, because it explains if you're becoming purified by knowledge of Krishna, without knowledge of Krishna, how can one actually become absorbed in Krishna? So one must know about Krishna, one must hear about Krishna, one must have transcendental knowledge about Krishna, and this transcendental knowledge about Krishna is far beyond transcendental knowledge about that we're not this body, that we're spirit soul. This is a different kind of transcendental knowledge. This is a different type of jnana. And when one has this knowledge of Krishna, one becomes purified. Putam madbhavam agatam. He becomes purified and he attains Krishna's transcendental nature and love for him. Now, each step is wonderful here. Being from free from attachment, material attachments, material fears, and material anger. So this was described, remember, in the covering over the soul was this lust and anger, attachments, passion and ignorance, and fear, like that. So when one is freed from these things due to transcendental knowledge, he becomes fully absorbed in Krishna. And then, thinking about Krishna, he surrenders to Krishna and takes shelter or refuge in him. These are just the points of the verse. And by doing that, many, many persons in the past became purified by knowledge of Krishna. This constant, just simply taking refuge in Krishna, taking shelter of Krishna, and then the result of that, being purified and taking shelter of Krishna and always thinking about Krishna, being absorbed in him, is madbhavam agata, that one attains transcendental love for Krishna. So we've moved into the second section already. Up to this verse, this is transcendental knowledge about Krishna. Now, in 11 through 15, how to apply this transcendental knowledge. So we've heard that Krishna is practically the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Of course, every verse starts with Sri Bhagavan Vacha almost, that the one Bhagavan means, Van means the possessor, and Bhaga means of all opulence and fortune. So Krishna possesses all opulence and fortune, which is, he's the Supreme Lord. So now Krishna explains something interesting, that we've just heard that one who who takes refuge in Krishna attains transcendental love for him, because that's what they want. They're devotees. So they take shelter of Krishna, and they pray to Krishna, and they want the shelter of his feet, and the result is madbhava magata. What does that mean? Yes, madbhavam, love for me. But what happens if one takes shelter of Krishna but doesn't want to attain transcendental love for him? Because people do that. They worship Krishna and they want liberation or they want material things. So do they get transcendental love for Krishna? What do you think? As all surrender to me, I reward them accordingly. Everyone follows my path in all respects, O son of Prita. So the devotees who worship Krishna with love, who want Krishna, who love Krishna, where do they go? Goloka Vrindavan. And the Mayavadis who think that Krishna's form and activities are not eternal, but they worship him. He's already said that they're eternal, and his body is eternal, but the Mayavadis think specifically that Krishna is a product of Maya, his body is a product of Maya. When Brahman comes to the material world, he becomes covered by the mode of goodness, and it's called Ishvara. Krishna also mentions this in chapter 9. This defeats Mayavad philosophy here. So the Mayavadis, although Krishna says that his form is eternal, they say that Krishna's form is temporary, and what happens to them? Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur describes they are given to Maya Devi for repeated birth and death. And the Brahmavadis, who are different from the Mayavadis, because the Brahmavadi, He may worship Krishna, but he wants Brahman. But he accepts Krishna's form as eternal. Different from a Mayavadi, he accepts Krishna's form as eternal. Mayavadis think it's temporary, but the Brahmavadis think that Krishna's form is eternal. And they worship Krishna, but to get to Brahman, because they think Brahman is higher. So there's a difference between Brahmavadis and Mayavadis. And what happens to Brahmavadis? They, by Krishna's grace, go to Brahman. By Krishna's grace. So, yeyetam mam prapadyante, and that's why Prabhupada talks about going to Brahman in Brahmajyoti in the purport to this verse, explaining these points. Now, then think about it. Knowing all these factors, Krishna is the Supreme Lord and He'll give you whatever you want. Why is it that some people don't surrender to Krishna? After all, if they have knowledge about Krishna, they should surrender to Krishna. Why do they worship to get material things? Why don't they worship Krishna even? Yayetam mam prapadyante. And the answer is given in text 12. Because men in this world desire success and fruit of activities, and therefore they worship the demigods. Quickly, of course, men get results from fruit of work in this world. So the answer is one of time. Because when when you worship Krishna, like Chatur Vidha Bhajante Mam Jana Sukritino Arjuna, Artiki Gyasarata Ti Gyani Cha Bharatasapa, Bharatasapa, that four different kinds of Sukritinas, or pious people, worship Krishna. One of them is the one who wants material things. So if you worship Krishna for material things, what's going to happen? You get material things. For sure. But Krishna is so kind that He'll purify your heart first. He'll give you your material things, but He'll exact some purification of the heart. And that takes some time. And people don't want that. So therefore, when they want their material things, they worship the demigods. Because quickly, of course, men get results from fruit of work in this world. And that's the difference between this level over here of karmakanda and sakama. Because with the increase in transcendental knowledge, the people, even though they have desires, they worship Krishna or Vishnu, or the Vedic system. Text 13. So it's interesting then, that there's different people in this world. Krishna is the Supreme, He's the Ishwara. He said He's the Ishwara already. And that He's the Supreme Lord. So one person is desiring to worship the demigods for fruit of results. Another person is desiring to worship Brahman. Another person is a Mayavadi. And another person is a devotee. Krishna is the Supreme Lord. And if He's the Param Ishwara, that means He's controlling everything. So therefore He's controlling everyone's desires. So is it Krishna who's controlling everyone and making one person a good devotee, and another person a bad devotee, another person a worse materialist? Is that Krishna? Is that the kind of Supreme Lord He is? So to address this question, because this is transcendental knowledge applied to work, Krishna first has described that He is the one who gives the fruit of everyone's work, ultimately. But now this very interesting question of what Krishna's relationship to everyone's karma is. Although He's giving the fruit of work, is He the one that's giving everyone the desire to? So He says here that according to the three modes of material nature and the work associated with them, the four divisions of human society are created by Me. So, and although I am the creator of the system, you should know that I am yet the non-doer, being unchangeable. This means that the Vanashrama system and the Vedic, which is basically the Vedic system, which is basically what we heard about in the beginning of chapter 3, that this Vanashrama system is set up to raise someone from the karmakanda consciousness, where one has material desires, to nishkama. It's a system that's been created for that purpose. It's His system. He has created the system, but how one fits in that system, He doesn't create. That is yayatam mam prapadyante. That is according to the desires of the living entity. So Krishna, he's just simply acting, reacting to people's desires, and therefore he is impartial in the awarding of the results of people's activities. So that when it explains that I am, in that verse, and although I am the creator of the system that gives everyone the fruits of their work, I am yet the non-doer. I am not the one who's directly awarding the fruits of the work. I've just created the system. I am not awarding the fruits of the work. I am the non-doer. That specifically means in awarding the fruit of work. Even though I am the one awarding the fruit of work, because everything's coming from me and I'm Parameshwara, I don't award the fruit of work, because it's the system that I set up. And being unchangeable. Now this fact that Krishna explained that he's unchangeable is a subtle technical fact why he has to explain that. Because according to Nyaya, if you react with something, if I'm the one who's involved in your life, if I'm directly involved in your life, awarding the fruits, because I'm dealing with you directly, therefore I must be changed. There must be some transformation in me. Because I'm reacting to what you do and giving you something different. So therefore Krishna says that he's the non-doer and he's unchangeable, because he's aloof. So Krishna has done something very tricky. But it's somewhat, it's an Achintya Bheda Bheda principle. That he said that I am the supreme controller and I'm the supreme personality of Godhead, but yet I'm not responsible for what happens to you. Because ultimately we have to take responsibility for what happens to us, even though everything depends on Krishna. It's a very tricky position, and it's a very subtle point what Krishna is doing here. He's saying he's the Supreme Lord, and everything's under his control, yet he's giving us the responsibility because he's given us free will. Then Krishna explains his non-doership, which is explained in Vidya Akartanam. He's the Akarta. Karta means doer. And it's very interesting. Later on, Krishna also explains Prakriti Kriyamanani Gunai Kamani Sarvasha Ahankara Vamudama Karta Hamiti Manyate. That a person who is bewildered by the three modes of material nature thinks Karta Ham, I am the doer. So Krishna says, if you think that you're the doer, you're Vamuda, and you're bewildered. But yet Krishna is saying here that he's not the doer either. So you're not the doer, Krishna's not the doer. So who's doing everything? So this philosophical point is very tricky, and it gets debated again and again in the Vedic system. And Krishna sometimes takes one side and sometimes takes the other side. And by the time we get to the 18th chapter, we'll understand why. But I'll probably tell you before. Kama Mamamsa says that we're the doer. All the six philosophical systems take up this point of who is the doer. Now, Krishna, in this verse over here, in text 14, Krishna explains his non-doership over here. How he acts, but he doesn't act. And why he's like that. And he explains it because he has non-attachment and impartiality. And because he's impartial, he's not bound and he's not changed by anything he does. And anyone who knows Krishna like this, who understands Krishna's position, this is applying transcendental knowledge again to work, helping us understand Krishna's position. Anyone who understands this, kamabhir nasabhadyate, he also doesn't become entangled in the fruits of his work. In other words, he becomes liberated. So the verse itself says, there is no work that affects me. I'm doing this, yet I'm not doing it. Nor do I aspire for the fruits of action. One who understands this truth about me also does not become entangled in the fruit of reactions of work. Because practically speaking, he understands that Krishna is the Lord, he's detached, and he worships Krishna. And he also doesn't become entangled in the fruit of reactions of the work. So all the work is going on by karma, which means the desires of the living entity. It's all the modes of material nature reacting with the living entity's desires. But in Krishna, Krishna says, I have no desire. So therefore I'm engaged in so many activities, paritranaya sadhanam, but it's completely desireless. And because there are no desires attached to my work, therefore I'm unbound by my work. And anyone who understands my position as being completely aloof from everything, he also doesn't become bound by work. And then finally, the last verse in this section of applying transcendental knowledge to work, understanding Krishna's position. All the liberated souls in ancient times acted with this understanding of my transcendental nature. Therefore, you should perform your duty following in their footsteps. So knowing this, Krishna's position, and acting for him, you should also act. And therefore, what does that mean practically for Arjuna? That he should fight. But he should fight in knowledge about Krishna's position. That Krishna wants him to fight. But yet, Krishna isn't like some clever politician instigating the fight to get his own ends met because he said he's aloof. And he's not attached to the fruit of the work. And therefore, unlike the politician, because Krishna is aloof, he's unbounded by his actions and his position is completely transcendental. So knowing this, Arjuna should fight in full knowledge of Krishna. And this is how everyone becomes liberated. Evam gyatva, thus knowing well, kritam, was performed, karma, purvai, by past authorities, api, indeed, mamukshubi, who attain liberation. In this way, everyone, past authorities, attain liberation. So fight, do your duty in knowledge about Krishna. So that was applying transcendental knowledge about work, knowing Krishna's aloof position. He's explained this position in the first section, in the second, how he's aloof. And if we do our duty conscious of Krishna's position, then we also become liberated as Krishna is liberated. Now the next section, 16 through 24, is tricky. And you can see this section is somewhat philosophical, maybe even a little more philosophical than the last chapter, this chapter, because this is knowledge. Knowledge is always philosophical. Now the next section describes karma, work, on the platform of jnana. And this is the most, there's some verses in here that are tricky. But they're not really that difficult. But they are tricky, and Krishna explains why that it is tricky right in verse 16. Even the intelligent are bewildered in determining what is action, what is inaction. Now I shall explain to you what action is, knowing which you shall be liberated from all misfortune. Now who is acting here? Who is doing what? Because there's been this discussion about who is the actor or the doer. Now Krishna is going to explain that. The intricacies of action are hard to understand. Therefore one should know properly what action is, what forbidden action is, and what inaction is. Now this is jnana type of knowledge. Purport. To understand Krishna consciousness and action according to its modes, one has to learn one's relationship with the Supreme. One who has learned perfectly knows that every living entity is an eternal servitor of the Lord and that consequently one has to act in Krishna consciousness. The entire Bhagavad Gita is directed towards this conclusion. Any other conclusions against this consciousness and its attendant actions are vikarma, or prohibited actions. To understand all this, one has to associate with authority in Krishna consciousness and learn the secret from them. This is as good as learning from the Lord directly. Otherwise, even the most intelligent person will be bewildered. So the issue that's being raised here that's so tricky is what one does that brings reactions. How to act. The issue here is how to act and not get any reactions for one's activities. So determining what actions bring reactions and what actions are as good as not acting at all is the question here. Now, the next verse is the one that's tricky to understand. But before explaining that, there's actually three Sanskrit terms in 4.17 that should be explained. Prabhupada's explained vikarma already in the purport. But there's three terms in the verse in Sanskrit. Karma, vikarma, and akarma. Now, karma is working with attachment. And the result of karma working with attachment is you get reactions. Then there's vikarma. Now, karma is working according to the scriptures and getting the reactions, the proper reactions, like karma kanda. Working properly according to the scriptures and getting the reactions. Vikarma is working against the scriptures. It's prohibited work. And you get a reaction for that. Now, one, the karma, you get a good reaction. And vikarma, you get a bad reaction. Then there is akarma. Now, akarma, sometimes we use the word karma to mean work, and sometimes, oh, it's your karma, means the reaction to your work, right? So when we say akarma, does that mean no work or no reaction?
Both.
Okay, so Krishna uses it here to mean no reaction and no work on the material level. So therefore, one who sees inaction in action, the English is hard to understand here, but it means one who sees inaction, that the modes of material nature, that you're actually, the soul is actually working. In action, when the soul is working and making the body work, so when the soul is working, that means the modes of material nature are not working. So when one is on the Krishna conscious level, the akarma level, working in Krishna consciousness, the soul works, the modes of material don't work, and he's actually working. So one who is seeing the inactivity of the modes of material nature in his work. And on the other hand, action and inaction, which means that the that when someone is working, the modes are working. Actually, I have it backwards here. Sorry. That when I'm acting, it's not me who's acting, it's the soul who's acting. Excuse me, it's the modes of material nature acting. When one's performing karma, it's the modes of material nature acting and the soul isn't acting, right? And then, action and inaction is when there is real action of the soul and inaction, or no reaction, because the modes of material nature aren't working. That's akarma. So a person who can see, distinguish, a person who can explain it as intelligent, what to speak of a person who can see it, is intelligent amongst men, and he's in the transcendental position. It's actually quite simple, but it's hard to explain. That when the soul is acting, then there is no reaction. When there is akarma, there is akarma. When there is no action of the body and action of the soul, there is no reaction. On the other hand, when there is action of the modes of material nature and the soul, there is no activity, there is karma or reaction. And one who can understand this, although it's very subtle, and when you see someone doing it, it's even more subtle because you can't tell the difference. Superficially, it looks the same. So Arjuna's fighting is action, right? Or is it inaction? It's inaction, because it's akarma. But the soul is action. So it's action and inaction. When Arjuna is fighting, it's akarma, because the soul is acting. It's not the modes of material nature acting. But for when Duryodhana is fighting, it is karma. When Arjuna is fighting, it's akarma. Even though they look like they're performing action. But one, in Duryodhana's case, he's actually inactive. Because it's the modes that are active. In Arjuna's case, he's actually inactive. He's actually active. And the modes are inactive. And the reaction comes to Duryodhana, so he gets karma. And Arjuna gets akarma. Because his action is akarma. Okay, everyone understand? I'm not going to ask this on the test, don't worry. Because I'm not going to mark it. Yeah.
You said that the soul is acting, no? But isn't there in the second chapter that it says that the soul is not the slayer and not the slain?
Right.
So that doesn't mean it's not acting.
But that, see, there's different levels of speaking. When we say the soul is not the slayer, we mean that the soul can't slay anyone because no, everyone is eternal. But when the soul is doing Krishna's service, he's actually acting. It's not the modes of material nature acting. He's still not slaying anyone, but he's actually acting because his natural position is to do what Krishna says. So he's actually acting. It's not the modes acting. Okay? So there's just different levels. Yeah. So this is jnana. This is understanding nishkam karma from the jnana platform. How one acting on the platform of knowledge is actually free from all reactions. Let me actually just finish this section and then ask questions. Call for questions. Now the next, because verse 18 that we read is so tricky, text 19 explains it further. One is understood to be in full knowledge, which is the akarma position, whose every endeavor is devoid of desire for sense gratification. This is easier to understand. He's akarma. He is said by sages to be a worker for whom the reactions of work have been burned up by the fire of perfect knowledge. So what makes a person akarma? When he has no desire for sense gratification. So that's nishkam karma. But what makes it bhakti, that in addition to not desiring sense gratification, he desires to please Krishna. So both are true for both bhakti and just nishkam karma yoga. Then 20 through 24 describes this akarma work. And that's the end of this section. We'll just read that quickly. Abandoning all attachments to the results of his activities, ever satisfied and independent, he performs no fruitive actions, although engaged in all kinds of undertakings. Such a man of understanding acts with mind and intelligence, perfectly controlled, gives up all sense of proprietorship over his possessions, and acts only for the bare necessities of life. Thus working, he is not affected by sinful reactions. He who is satisfied with gain which comes of its own accord, who is free from duality and does not envy, who is steady in both success and failure, is never entangled, although performing actions. Again, this is a description of akarma. The work of a man who is unattached to the modes of material nature and who is fully situated in transcendental knowledge merges entirely into transcendence. And here's the summary of akarma work. A person who is fully absorbed in Brahma Arpanam, in spiritual nature and Krishna consciousness, Brahma Havir, sacrificing for the Supreme, is sure to attain the spiritual kingdom because of his full contribution to spiritual activities, in which the consummation is absolute, that which is offered is of the same spiritual nature. So his work becomes a veritably sacrifice. Because Krishna is explaining here, work as a sacrifice, explaining it from the point of view of what was described in chapter 3 of performing sacrifices. So actually one's work becomes absolute by offering it to the Supreme Lord. Okay. Questions? Yeah. So this is just understanding karma on the jnana platform, or in the mood of jnana. Just understanding this transcendental knowledge. Yeah.
So a karma, is only devotional service is a karma, or something else can be a karma?
Yeah, work that's done completely dutifully without attachment is a karma. Nishkam karma also.
Nishkam karma is also a karma.
Yeah.
Because it's detached.
Yeah, because you're completely detached. The thing that brings the reaction is the attachment. Therefore, we're recommended to be detached from the fruit of our work, and therefore passion, which brings attachment, is an enemy. And that's what binds us to the fruits of, to the reactions, is attachment. So detached work brings no reaction.
We said that real activities come from the soul.
Yes.
Level.
Yes.
So how can we understand, as Krishna said, that the mode of material nature. There, it's nothing. It's not the spiritual.
Right. So, there's three things. There's three things that there's possibility of doing. The doer. This is the question of doership again. Who is the doer? Krishna's already said, as the Supreme Lord, he's not the doer. He's made the system. The system is the law of karma, right? And in that system is the modes of is the living entity. And Krishna said, if the living entity thinks that he's the doer, he's an illusion. So that leaves the doership to the modes of material nature. But as you're pointing out, the modes of material nature are unconscious. So how can they be the doer? So therefore the answer is that no one is doing anything. Is that a fact? Who is the doer? You? Are you the doer? Everyone's been looking. But that's Krishna. No, the modes of material nature are unconscious.
They are? Is that why they have a deity that presides over each one?
No, they do have a presiding deity, but they're basically unconscious. Because it's pradhan, it's just matter. And if there's a deity presiding over each one, then there's who is the one who set up the system? You go back to that again.
Jivas is the one who gives the impulse, like the person in a computer gives the electricity.
So I'm wondering if we could have fun and then argue all the different sides of this. Because one could say, well, the impulse comes from where? Prabhupada explains in the purport that desire is a subtle form of conditioning. That means your impulses are also conditioned by the modes of material nature. So therefore it goes back to the modes being the doer.
Because before the modes, when we come to the modes, why do we come? We want to become in touch with the modes.
We want to become in touch with the modes. So that means that... But this is what Krishna is talking about here, that from the point of view of Paramatma, he's neutral. He's not doing it. But the answer is that the Baladeva Vidyabhushan and everyone, all the great acharyas have answered that actually the living entity is the doer, but he's not the only doer. But he has to take responsibility for himself. But we tend to think we're the only doer. That because of my great effort and my power, I have done so much. So to stop us from thinking like that, Krishna explains that, he'll explain later, that one who thinks that he's doing it, ahankara vimudatma kartahamiti manyate, one who thinks he's the doer, meaning the only doer, is just bewildered and an illusion. But actually the impulse is coming from his desires. And the argument that Baladeva Vidyabhushan said gives is that, and it's given in the, he explains the same thing in Shruti Stuti, in his commentary on the prayers of the personified Vedas. He explains that if the living entity had no freedom of doership, then what would be the use of the Vedic injunctions instructing him to do one thing to go to heaven or another thing to go to get his desires? So he uses the Vedas to prove that the living entity has free will and doership. But he's not the only doer, that's the point. And once he starts doing a little bit, he gets entangled, then the modes of material nature really take over. But Krishna's playing his flute. And Krishna explains that even as the Paramatma, he's not forcing it. Because samoham sarvabhuteshu is equal to everyone. It's just giving people what they want. It's getting late, or it is late rather. It's almost tomorrow. Okay.
You come from the sense gratification level to karma kanda.
Well, that's also sense gratification.
Yes, but I mean, how do you stick with sense
gratification? Right. What brings you there?
Yeah, how do you get to karma kanda?
The whole Vedic system.
So, accepting the Vedic system.
Yeah, accepting the Vedic culture.
And the Vedic system itself brings you from karma kanda to
sankhya. No, it brings you to karma. If you're lucky, if you get the right association,
from the brahmanas. So that brings you to Sankalpa Karma.
Yeah.
And the transition from lower
level. And you mentioned to. So we explained this in the beginning that there's many things that bring you from this level to this. There's different stages of karma kanda. One trying to get things in this life, and then going for another life.
Yeah, the
and
higher planets.
Yeah, and then you realize that you're not your body. And then as long as you realize you're not your body, then you might as well get rid of all bodily pleasures and miseries by becoming detached. And like that, gradually, once you follow the Vedic system, then knowledge starts developing.